This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Hello and welcome. Today is a little bit different. I'm not changing my format or anything. I wanted to start a little series of some of the differences between Canada and the US when it comes to murder. And I will only discuss murder. It's kind of the only crime that I'm really somewhat educated on. I don't want to get into any other crimes. I'm hoping that you like this series where I can just pop in an episode here and there, just explaining some of the differences in the laws and stuff like that you'll see between Canada and the US when it comes to justice with regards to murder. And if you don't like it, you don't have to leave a comment or anything. So for this first episode, we're going to talk a little bit about just some of the differences with regards to justice around murder in general. So we won't be talking about a specific case. There's no heartbreaking victim story, no courtroom drama here, but we are going to be digging into a topic that kind of shapes every one of the stories that I do tell, and that's around the law. And not just any law, but the strange, often surprising ways that Canadian and American murder laws kind of diverge. Because depending on which side of the border that you're on, murder doesn't always mean the same thing. So we'll start simple. In Canada, we've got 2 degrees of murder. First degree means the killing was planned and deliberate. Think premeditation, kind of a step-by-step setup. But there is a little bit of a twist. It's also automatically first degree if it happens during certain crimes. Kidnapping, sexual assault, hijacking, or terrorism for some examples. Second degree is everything else that's intentional but not pre-planned. Now in the US, it's a little bit messier because there's no single definition. Every state has its own criminal code, and while most also use first and second degree, what that means can actually vary quite widely. Some states will even tack on capital murder if the death penalty is on the table, and others have aggravated murder. It's like kind of a buffet of terminology there, so kind of take your pick. So felony murder is kind of where there's a big divide, and things get a little bit spicy. In the US, many states use what's called the felony murder rule. So let's say you and your friend rob a store. Don't do that, but let's say that you did. It's very hypothetical. You've got no gun. You don't mean to hurt anybody, but the clerk then has a heart attack and dies. Well, congratulations, you might be facing a murder charge, even though you didn't intend to kill anyone. So that's felony murder. It basically says if someone dies while you're committing a felony, you are responsible whether you intended to anything to happen or not. Now in Canada, no. That rule was tossed out in 1990 in a Supreme Court case called R.V. Martineau. The judges said that if you're going to convict someone of murder, the Crown has to prove subjective forethought of death, meaning you actually realized that your actions were likely to cause someone's death. intent matters in Canada. And that is a huge philosophical difference between our systems. In Canada, murder is about what's in your head and in your mind. But in many US states, it's about what happened, even if you didn't see it coming. Now, when it comes to sentencing, life means life, or does it? So when it comes to punishment, Canada's approach is way more standardized. If you're convicted of murder here, you get a mandatory life sentence. There's no bargaining, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, no exceptions. The only question then is when you can start asking for parole. So with first degree, you can apply for parole after 25 years, and second degree, the judge kind of decides on that, and it's anywhere between 10 and 25 years, and that is it. We also do not have a death penalty. We abolished that in 1976. But for years, judges could stack those 25-year ineligibility periods for multiple murders. That ended in 2022 in the Bissonnette case, who was the Quebec City mosque shooter, where the Supreme Court said that no one can be denied a realistic chance of parole for the rest of their lives. So even he is going to get a parole hearing after 25 years, and that includes Dustin. And yes, that ruling made a lot of people very angry, including myself. Meanwhile, south of the border, it's kind of a patchwork quilt of extremes. Now, some states have life with parole, some have life without parole, and 27 states still have the death penalty, though a few like California and Pennsylvania have moratoriums in place currently. So your punishment for murder depends really heavily on where you committed it. Self-defense is another big cultural flashpoint. In Canada, there's one little neat section, Section 34 of the Criminal Code, that covers all of that self-defense stuff. It basically says you can defend yourself if you believe force or a threat is happening, if you act for a defensive purpose, and if what you do is reasonable in the circumstances, which seems very simple. There's no castle doctrine. There's no stand your ground laws. But in the US, it's state by state again. So some states say that you must retreat if you can safely do so. But others, like Florida, say that you can stand your ground anywhere that you have a lawful right to be. So that's why you see such a difference in the outcomes in self-defense cases, depending on, again, where they happen. If you have ever watched Law and Order, you can probably recite the Miranda warning by heart. You have the right to remain silent, anything you say can be used against you, blah, blah, blah. Now in Canada, we don't actually say that, but we have something that's kind of similar under Section 10B of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So when you're arrested or detained here, the police have to tell you about your right to counsel. And they cannot start interrogating you until you've actually had a chance to talk to a lawyer. They're supposed to hold off on questioning. It's kind of a subtle difference. But in practice, Canadian police have to be extra careful about timing and access to that counsel, because if they don't do that, then your whole confession might get tossed out. And since we're talking about confessions, let's talk a little bit about this infamous Mr. Big operation, which is a uniquely Canadian invention, where undercover officers pose as members of this criminal organization. They befriend a suspect, and then eventually they pressure them into confessing to a real crime so that they can kind of join this gang. It's been used surprisingly successfully in a bunch of high-profile cases, but it also led to a couple of false confessions. So in 2014, the Supreme Court ruled in this R.V. Hart case that Mr. Big confessions are presumptively inadmissible unless the prosecutors can prove that they're reliable and the police didn't cross any ethical lines. So yes, it's legal, but it's heavily restricted now. And you definitely will not see a Mr. Big sting on any American TV crime shows. And just to kind of explain some of this preemptively inadmissible, it means that basically when there's a Mr. Big confession, it is automatically considered inadmissible unless they can show that in the confession, there was information that could only be known by the person that actually committed the crime. So that is why in a lot of cases that I cover that happen here in Canada, I'll talk a lot about hold back evidence. And that is evidence that they hold back from the media purposely so that if there ever is a confession, they can use that information as something that only the actual killer would actually know. So if they can prove that, and if they can prove that they didn't in some way coerce a confession out of the person, then they can use it. In that RV Hart case, I did cover that case. It's a man who was convicted of killing his two young daughters by drowning them. And the reason they sort of threw out his confession was because he was involved in a Mr. Big sting, was because that he... I don't know how to say it. He had some cognitive function issues, and so they kind of felt like he was, he just didn't realize that he was confessing to something bad. It was a really complicated case, and quite frankly, I don't agree that it was a false confession, but. Anyways, that's a whole other case there. So here's another difference that I think a lot of people don't know about. Canada actually abolished that preemptory challenges in 2019 when it comes to jurors. So that means lawyers can no longer dismiss jurors without giving a reason. The goal was to kind of reduce racial biases after the Colton Bushy case, which I also covered that one. And in the U.S., those challenges still exist, but the Supreme Court's Batson versus Kentucky ruling says that you can't strike jurors because of race or gender. Does it still happen? Let's just say yes. And it's still being fought about quite a bit. Both countries require unanimous jury verdicts now. The U.S. made that official in 2020 after Ramos versus Louisiana. So for once, we kind of line up about something there. If you are charged with murder in Canada, you are facing a reverse onus situation. So that means that you have to show why you should be released on bail. And unlike most charges where the Crown has to prove why you shouldn't be released on bail, and murder bail hearings can only happen in Superior Court. They're very rare and they're very strict. Now, in the U.S., bail laws vary widely again. Some states have mandatory detention for capital murder. Others still allow judges' discretion, or they use these risk assessment tools. So again, it really depends on your zip code. Now, here is a difference that I'd like telling listeners because it always kind of surprises people. In Canada, there is no such thing as a no contest or Alfred plea. You can plead guilty or not guilty, and that's it. Now, in the U.S., defendants can say, I'm not admitting guilt, but I'll take the sentence. And that's called an Alfred plea. Now, Canada does not play that game. There is a partial defense called provocation, which can reduce murder to manslaughter, but it's a lot narrower now. Like, you can't just say, well, she made me mad. It has to be a sudden, shocking act that would cause an ordinary person to lose control. And even then, it's a really steep hill to climb. So what do all these differences tell us? At its core, Canadian criminal law leans toward intent and towards rehabilitation and uniformity. Everyone convicted of murder gets life. Everyone's parole eligibility fits the same framework. In the U.S., on the other hand, they lean towards states' rights, retribution, and discretion. You can face a death sentence in Texas and parole in 15 years in another state for the exact same crime. Neither system, of course, is perfect. Canada gets a lot of flack for being too lenient. The U.S. gets criticized for being too harsh. But they reflect two very different ideas of what justice should look like. And that's why when I cover cases on this show, it's always worth remembering How the story unfolds depends not just on what happened, but where it happened. Because borders don't just divide land, they actually divide justice as well. So thank you for hanging out with me today for this little legal road trip between Canada and the US. I hope that you learned something new, or you just enjoy hearing about some weird quirks of the justice systems. And thank you so much for listening.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.